Good Tuesday afternoon. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for December 8th, 2020. Ahead this hour, a new landlord registry in Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has that story. In our second half hour, John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, talks with Roby Brock from Our Partner Talk Business and Politics. They'll cover how state politicians are reacting to the president's continued insistence that last month's election was rigged. After our show on Here and Now from NPR, as the United Kingdom begins vaccinating people with the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine this week, a key FDA panel is expected to approve the vaccine for use in the United States. We'll hear the view from London and all the latest news on Here and Now, beginning at 1 this afternoon on 91.3. The Arkansas Department of Health is adding 53 deaths to the state's list of COVID-19 fatalities. That's the highest one-day addition since the start of the pandemic. There were just more than 1,000 newly confirmed cases of the virus in the most recent testing cycle and another 114 probable cases. Hospitalizations from coronavirus dropped by 23 patients, though there are still more than 1,000 Arkansas hospital beds dedicated to people with the virus. There are 743 fewer active cases in the state today, still just more than 18,000. Governor Asa Hutchinson will host a community meeting concentrating on the surge of virus cases in the state in Springdale tomorrow morning. The session is one of three to be held. There will be similar meetings in Benton and Jonesboro. The governor will also address the entire state with a primetime speech about COVID-19 Thursday evening at 7. A new civil engineering research center in the Arkansas Research and Technology Park will be named for alumnus Grady E. Harville in honor of his support of the project. The more than 37,000-square-foot facility will be named the Grady E. Harville Civil Engineering Research and Education Center in honor of Harville, who graduated with a bachelor's degree in civil engineering in 1972 and is the president of W&W AFCO Steel. An estate gift commitment from the Harville family helped the project reach its final fundraising goal, and it's now under construction. It will include a high-bay structural testing facility with a 4-foot-thick strong floor capable of testing large-scale structural systems and components. The Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team is adding a game against Southern University tomorrow night to its schedule. The game will tip off at 7 in Bud Walton Arena. Arkansas's game with Tulsa, originally set for tonight in Tulsa, was postponed because of positive coronavirus tests among the Tulsa team. Clear in the region tonight, lows from 34 to 37. More sunny conditions tomorrow with highs around 70. Good Tuesday. This is Ozarks at Large. Just ahead, the second part of our conversation with Dr. Jose Romero, Arkansas's Secretary of Health. The city of Fayetteville is now collecting information for its new Landlords Representative Registry. The database is being created to make it easier for residents to contact landlords in emergency or to resolve an issue with a neighboring property. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Councilmember Teresa Turk sponsored the ordinance, which the Fayetteville City Council unanimously approved during its August 18th meeting. Turk says many residents had reached out to her asking for an easier way to contact landlords. The Ward 4 Position 1 council member has personal experience with the issue. Prior to running for city council, she served as treasurer for the University Heights Neighborhood Organization.
Well, many of the neighbors had asked for a landlord registry for a long, long time, for many, many years, to deal with different issues. Sometimes it was loud noise from a party, too many cars. Other times it was simply trying to find the property owner so they could discuss things like putting a new fence in or a tree that needed to be cut down, you know, these kinds of shared property or areas. And they had many, many difficult times getting a hold of the landlord, especially if it was owned by a corporation. Because if you look on the Washington County assessor's website, it just has an address. So there's no phone number, there's no email address.
As someone who owns rental properties, Turk has also experienced trouble as a landlord trying to contact the owner of a neighboring property.
I could go and talk to the tenants, but that was hard to catch them, or they would be hesitant to provide that information. And so this is just kind of a practical solution to a problem that many residents have around here.
Under the new ordinance, landlords with more than two long-term rental properties within the city are required to provide the name and contact information of a designated representative to serve as a point of contact for renters and their neighbors. The representative's full name, telephone number, email address, and mailing address must be submitted to the online registry.
And it doesn't have to be a physical address. It can be a P.O. box. I know some people are concerned that they don't want tenants or old tenants showing up at their house. But, you know, really the idea is to expedite the process, make it easier by using a phone number or an email address rather than the actual physical address of the owner.
According to the city, designated representatives should have the power to respond to questions and issues of tenants and must live or work in Washington, Benton, Crawford, or Madison County. The initial registration period opened December 1st and will continue until April 30th, 2021. Those who fail to register by the deadline will be subject to fines. Councilmember Turk says other cities like Springdale have landlord registries.
A lot of those are just used internally, like for the city to get a hold of landlords. But, you know, we're a college town, and I think we really pride ourselves on transparency and friendliness and cooperation. So I hope that there's no abuse of this.
The Fayetteville Registry will be publicly accessible May 1st, 2021. Garner Stoll, Development Services Director, says officials are pulling information from the city's business license program as a basis for the new Landlord's Representative Registry.
If you have a rental more than three units, you need to get a business license, and our renewal is generally in October, so our renewal of the business licenses is coming through the process right now. It's towards ending, and that's what we use to get the information.
If the point of contact for renters and neighbors should be someone other than who's listed on the business license, you'll be able to update that in the new registry. Any change to landlord representation must be updated on the registry within 7 days to ensure information remains up to date. There is no fee to register or to access and search the registry once it becomes publicly available next year. To register or for additional information, you can visit fayetteville-ar.gov/landlord. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With at least two COVID-19 vaccines on the brink of receiving emergency use authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, we reached out to Arkansas Secretary of Health Dr. Jose Romero about what the rollout will look like in Arkansas. Dr. Romero is also the chair of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with him on Friday. Part one of their interview aired on our show yesterday and can be found at ozarksatlarge.com. Here is part two of their conversation.
As we discussed in part one of this interview, this vaccine will be given to groups of people in tiers. One of the tiers is 1B, which includes essential workers. And one of the examples you gave was postal workers earlier in our conversation. Who else will be in that group? Because essential worker is a pretty broad term. So how is the state approaching that?
There's an organization, a governmental organization called CISA, CISA, which I'm sure you've heard about. And they have defined what are the priority groups. So within those priority groups, there are individuals that need to get the vaccine. So certainly in that essential work group would include, for example, people that work at stores, right, that stock the shelves, right, that come in and take care of doing that. So the checkers, the people that keep the machinery running. So we'll see these, and we'll need to decide, you know, what groups are going to fit in there and give some guidance as to how to prioritize them. And that also applies, for example, within the healthcare provider group, which I think you've read or heard that, you know, the healthcare providers, we're not just talking about doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists. We're talking about the people that are essential to make that institution run. So, and the example I always use is, you know, housekeeping, who's got to go into that emergency room, that room where that patient was, clean that room up and get the patient and get it ready for the next one. Those individuals are very important. We need to protect them also.
When you spoke before lawmakers earlier this week, you said the state would not mandate this vaccine. I'm wondering if that'll be the case for, say, private employers or institutions like hospitals.
This vaccine, because it's under a EUA, will not be mandated in that form. I mean, because it's not been FDA licensed. So I think that's the big impediment for making it a mandatory vaccine for healthcare providers or for any industry or the state in general. We don't, outside of vaccines that need to be given to children, right, to go to school, there are vaccines that I, as a physician, have to have because my institution says it's important. If I don't get them, I can't practice at that site. Flu vaccine or the pertussis vaccine, those are important. But you cannot, you know, this vaccine will not be mandated, I think.
So once these vaccines get rolled out, what percentage of Arkansans will need to get vaccinated in order for these vaccines to have this intended effect of herd immunity?
Well, I would hope that everybody would get the vaccine. But, you know, the discussions have been that somewhere between 65 to 75% of the population need to receive the vaccine in order to develop herd immunity. So, you know, that would be okay, but I really want to shoot for much more than that. I want to see the vast majority of the state receive the vaccine that are eligible, provided the vaccine is safe and available. Now, you know, we're going to miss the kids, right? The kids are out of this equation at this point, and they should be, you know, they will enter into the equation. But, you know, removing that group, you know, we're going to have to still get the 65%. That may mean we have to vaccinate many more adults in order to hit the 65 or 75% here in the state, because you're removing the kids right now.
Pfizer has been given an emergency authorization in the UK. So I'm wondering, what will you be looking for as vaccinations start there?
Yeah, very, very good question. I think we can use that to inform us about how difficult it is to transport the vaccine, how difficult it is to use up the vaccine that you're allotted without wasting it. I am concerned that vaccine not be wasted. Right, that if you get five doses, that those five doses find five arms to go into. I've said to my staff, somewhat hyperbolic, but I'll cry for every dose we lose, right? Because it's been so hard to get here, right? That to lose a dose, a precious dose, is almost unacceptable.
And speaking of getting to this point, can you give us an idea of how truly quickly this vaccine was developed?
Yeah, I haven't had a lot of questions about that, but that is a very good one. So typically it takes about somewhere between 10 to 20 years, 15 years, we say, to get a vaccine from the concept through the animal studies and then into humans and then the human trials. And then the FDA licensure and ACIP approval process and recommendations. So this has been cut down to about 10 months, right? So, you know, the creation, the first start of this vaccine was when we learned about the genomic sequence of the virus, right? Immediately after that, you know, the scientists knew where they wanted to go. And a lot of this has been informed by what previous work was done on two other viruses, so two other coronaviruses, and also coronaviruses that are common, the four common coronaviruses. So using, you know, studies that were done with that, using vaccine studies that were done on the original SARS virus, which had an outbreak, I think in 2003 is when it was, and then the Middle Eastern coronavirus, which is also caused a localized outbreak. So development of vaccines for that area, for those two viruses, was undertaken, and so we've learned things from doing that. So now we take that information, and we can use it to accelerate identifying, for example, the antigen that we're using. And most of these vaccines are now using what's called the spike protein. And so we know with the sequence, which is really the key, because that's how that molecular aspect of it has allowed us to make that protein in a test tube with the right bacteria or whatever we're going to do, and then we can purify and inject it. So that has really accelerated. The other thing that's different about this whole process is that it has been compressed. So normally you do clinical trials in three phases, right? Phase one is a very small group of adults to see how they amount an immune response. There's always safety involved. How did they tolerate it? The second one, second phase is usually a dose finding phase where you give different doses, check the immune response, check the reactivity of the vaccine, see if there's any side effects. Again, safety, safety, safety. And then finally, you decide on what the doses are, and then you inject a number of adults to do that. And those phases actually have been run in parallel in many cases. So you're running phase one and two and two and three together. And so you can accelerate, you can compress the time together. But then after that goes the authorization. Now, I think one thing I'd like to say at this point, although you haven't asked it, is that it's very important for the public to understand that safety has been paramount throughout this. And it was stated by the pharmaceutical companies. All of them got together and came up with a joint statement, which they all agreed on. The FDA has clearly stated from the very beginning, we're not rushing this. This vaccine will receive the same scrutiny that any other vaccine is. Their documents have stated clearly that the safety parameters for this vaccine will be the same as for other vaccines that were used to prevent infectious diseases in the past. And my group, the ACIP, where I sit on, that also is primary. We have actually not issued a formal recommendation. We've issued interim recommendations pending seeing the efficacy and safety data. And the other thing that the public needs to know is that even after both ACIP and FDA rule on this, give their opinion, there'll be a fourth phase of safety, which is the post-marketing phase. And so we'll use systems that already exist, we know work very well, and the CDC has added to those other systems so that we can catch any signals that show a potential problem with a vaccine.
So ACIP stands for Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, and it's part of the CDC. You are a chair of that committee. Can you tell us what the ACIP does?
So, regulatory issues are handled primarily by the FDA, right? So they are the ones that license a vaccine, and they have their own advisory board called the VRBPAC, or Vaccines and Related Biological Advisory Committee. And so the VRBPAC makes a recommendation to the director of the FDA, and the director of the FDA takes that into consideration and makes a decision about whether to license or not. So once the vaccine, and this is traditionally, once the vaccine is licensed or approved by the FDA, then it's handed off to the ACIP. And what ACIP does is they determine which groups the vaccine is to be used for and whether we also feel it's safe. So the ACIP is the group, for example, that determines the normal vaccine schedule for children. So we come up every year with modifications of that based on data that we have. And then we make a recommendation to the director of the CDC, and he or she determines whether that recommendation is appropriate. And then if it is, then that's relayed back to HHS, Health and Human Science Services. In traditional vaccines, what happens next, and this has happened already, is that when we make a recommendation, it's published in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. when it's published, that's when it becomes official. In this case, it's not so much, but for vaccines like childhood or adult vaccines, the fact that the ACIP approved it and it gets published means then that insurance companies have to pay for this. So children, for example, that's one of the important things about the ACIP ruling on it, is that for childhood vaccines, if it's approved by the ACIP, it must be covered by insurance companies or by vaccines for children if they don't have insurance. And for adults, it's the ACA or insurance companies that need to then cover the cost of that vaccine. So it's important from a healthcare delivery point and an equity point. It allows people to have access to these vaccines.
Thank you very much for your time, Dr. Romero.
Thank you.
That was Arkansas Secretary of Health, Dr. Jose Romero, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek. He is also the chair of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Part one of our interview can be found at OzarksAtLarge.com. We ran out of time to ask Dr. Romero all the questions we had for him as he had to prepare for another interview. But last week, he told legislators preliminary data shows the Pfizer vaccine is more than 90% effective in preventing COVID-19 infection with minimal safety concerns, although recipients may experience fever as well as pain and swelling at the injection site.
It's time for the annual KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. It's your chance to win a gift from KUAF and one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include Fayetteville Roots Festival, Downtown Springdale Alliance, Dog Party USA, and more. Winners announced Friday, December 11th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Details and registration available at KUAF.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, and this is Ozarks at Large. This is the winter end-of-year fundraising week at 91.3 KUAF. This is when we take just a couple of minutes in between interviews and stories in all of our shows to remind you that the reason we can bring you these shows is because you help us pay for them. You can support your public radio station with an end-of-year gift at supportkuaf.com. Facts, knowledge, understanding, insight, inspiration, community. That's what you know you will find when you connect with 91.3. And this is why it matters so much. There's never been a moment when it's been more important to stand up for fearless journalism that insists on truth, transparency, and accountability. And there's never been a moment when it's been more important to support broad access to accurate reporting, tough investigations, and constructive conversations. That's what you hear throughout the day on 91.3 KUAF, beginning with Morning Edition, running through 1A, Fresh Air, Ozarks at Large, and into All Things Considered. This is why it also matters that you make your contribution of support right now. Put a bit of your dollars behind something that you believe in, something we all need. You can contribute right now, safely and securely, at supportkuaf.com. And for this end-of-year fundraiser, we are offering some special gifts to you as thank yous for your contribution. For a gift of $60 or $5 a month, you can select an Ozarks at Large 30th anniversary poster. We've been bringing this locally produced news magazine for more than 30 years now. Our reporters have been covering news, sports, politics, arts, and culture for three decades. And this year, the work that Jacqueline and Antoinette and Zuzana and Timothy and Daniel have done surrounding justice reform, the virus, and elections has been outstanding. That poster is yours for a gift of $60 or a contribution of $5 a month as a sustaining member. And then for a gift of $240 or $20 a month as a sustaining member, you can request a special KUAF Ozarks at Large double CD, a collection of 16 interviews and stories from those three decades of this program. The Ozarks at Large collection, a unique collection of history. You won't find anything like it anywhere else. A little bit later this hour, we'll hear just a snippet from one of the pieces that's included on that CD. That's yours with a commitment of $20 a month as a sustaining member or a one-time gift of $240. You can make that contribution, and you can make a contribution in any amount right now at supportkuaf.com. KUAF 91.3, a reflection of what you value in news coverage. We're independent journalism for independent thinkers. We're also commercial-free. We get the majority of our funding from listeners just like you, the people who value independence in their lives and their communities. As this year is drawing to a close, we're asking you to support quality journalism for our community. You can make a tax-deductible contribution right now at supportkuaf.com. And from all of us at 91.3 KUAF and from all of us at Ozarks at Large, thank you very much. This is Ozarks at Large. Research physician and professor Dr. Neil Palafox has worked for over a quarter of a century to improve health outcomes for Pacific Islanders, including Marshallese. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich recently spoke with him, he resides in Hawaii, about the scope of his work, which now includes responding to a global pandemic in Pacific Island communities.
Neil Palafox, MD, is a professor at the John Burns School of Medicine at the University of Hawaii Cancer Center.
I'm a physician, so I teach family medicine residents and interns and teach medical students, and I have a large research portfolio, including many different NIH and CDC grants. And also for this COVID pandemic in the state of Hawaii, I work with four different COVID response teams, including Pacific Islander response teams, and with the International Repatriation of the Pacific response teams.
For over 25 years, Palafox has worked to improve the health capacity as well as health policies for U.S.-affiliated Pacific Island territories and jurisdictions, including the Republic of the Marshall Islands, located 2,000 miles southwest of Hawaii.
We actually have developed the CDC-based cancer registry in the U.S.-affiliated Pacific, which includes the RMI. And from 2007 to 2017, latest data, the most prevalent cancer, cervical cancer, lung cancers, 2, breast cancers, 3, liver cancer, uterine nasopharyngeal, colorectal cancer, ovarian leukemia are the top 8 or 9 cancers.
During the Cold War from 1946 to 1958, the Marshall Islands, then a U.S. territory, was used by the U.S. military to detonate 67 nuclear weapons tests with the cumulative radioactive yield of more than 7,000 Hiroshima bombs. Palafox served as the principal investigator for Department of Energy Special Medical Care Program, first implemented in 1954 by the Atomic Energy Commission, which provided medical surveillance of radiation-exposed downwind Marshallese.
Nuclear testing is related to ionizing radiation, is related to 23 different types of cancers, and certainly thyroid cancer in the past has been related, but currently is not in the top 10.
The University of Hawaii Cancer Center and University of Guam were each recently awarded a 5-year, $14 million grant from the National Cancer Institute to mitigate the impact of cancer among certain Pacific Island nations, of which Palafox is a co-principal investigator. The program is known as the Pacific Island Partnership for Cancer Health Equity.
And the idea is to develop cancer research capacity in both of these institutions, focused on cancers and cancer research that is relevant to these areas. And over time, to then evolve that relationship to have indigenous Pacific Island cancer researchers that cover the entire U.S.-affiliated Pacific and subsequently into the South Pacific.
The project, first established in 2003, is the only NCI-funded Pacific-based partnership that addresses cancer disparities in the peoples of Hawaii, Guam, Northern Mariana Islands, American Samoa, the Federated States of Micronesia, Palau, and the Marshall Islands.
This partnership is stepping up to develop the capacity so that over time there will be Marshall Islands indigenous researchers that do cancer research, including research around the nuclear and other common cancers and concerns in the Marshall Islands.
When a global pandemic was declared last March, certain Pacific Island nations closed their borders. By June, U.S. military workers were allowed to enter the Republic of the Marshall Islands, but that resulted in 4 presumptive cases. The small outbreak was contained, Palafox says, who serves on a special medical task force advising the RMI.
In the rest of the Marshall Islands, they're being very cautious because there are no cases that are community transmitted within their borders, and they want to keep it that way. But it's a lot of work, a lot of thinking around how to do this correctly, and it, to be real frank, it costs a lot of money and time.
The U.S. continues to maintain a strategic military base in the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and under a treaty, Marshallese are free to live and work in the U.S., with as many as 15,000 settled in northwest Arkansas. Of those, 2,600 have tested positive for COVID-19. According to the State Department of Health, 48 islanders have died, comprising half of all deaths in the region. So the question is, are Marshallese more at risk for COVID-19 due to their nuclear legacy?
People who are part of the nuclear testing era have many reasons to have a depressed immune system. A lot of them currently are around, you know, their culture being destroyed, identity being destroyed, movement from their homes, forced evacuation, you know, so it's all the stress factors that relate to that. It's diseases associated with that movement, you know, being put on non-nutritious diets, USDA foods because they could not grow their own foods and so forth. Then there's, as you can imagine, there's questions about genetic transgenerational effects of ionizing radiation, but a lot of those questions haven't been answered. So could that be playing a part in the COVID? Not all of it can be attributable to the immune suppression from nuclear testing, though, like you're suggesting, could that track? Yes, that could.
No data exists to prove a link, but Palafox says islanders do live communally, share everything, and attend large traditional gatherings. Obesity, diabetes, heart disease also make Pacific Islanders vulnerable to the virus. Hawaii, where Dr. Neil Palafox lives, counts 18,000 Micronesians, including Chukis, Tongans, Samoans, and 11,000 Marshallese, a population which currently owns, he says, 30% of all COVID infections in his state. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This autumn, KUAF's roster of podcasts continues to grow, and there are new episodes of three of those podcasts that you can listen to right now. Reflections is a podcast about how music can be a source of healing and change. Its first episode debuted last month. It's hosted by two familiar voices to regular listeners of Ozarks at Large, Antoinette Grajeda and Leah Uribe. The second episode of The New Classroom, produced and hosted by Zuzanna Sitek, also now available for you to hear. It features reporting from Ozarks at Large staff about how education has changed and continues to change as the pandemic continues. And the second episode of The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, is ready for you as well. Late last month, I hosted a virtual panel discussion with the podcast executive director, Paul Kiefer, and other guests. That session, which was co-hosted by the Fayetteville Public Library, was recorded and can be viewed at faylib.org. We're going to have another panel discussion associated with the ongoing series in January, again, co-hosted with the Fayetteville Public Library. But you can hear the most recent episodes of Reflections, of The New Classroom, and of The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, right now by going to KUAF.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. A fast-growing region needs high-quality health care. UAMS Northwest Regional Campus in Fayetteville is educating the future of healthcare. uams.info/future for more information.
This is a Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks so much for being with us. Don't forget, you can always listen to the most recent edition of our program by just asking your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large. This is a fundraising week at 91.3 KUAF. It's the end of year winter fundraising week when we give you a pretty easy opportunity to make a tax-deductible end-of-year contribution to your public radio station. You can just go to supportkuaf.com. No phone calls as the virus and pandemic continue. We remain on lockdown in the building, only staff inside, which means no phone volunteers, so no phone contributions, but you can make your contribution in the amount of your choosing at supportkuaf.com. KUAF.com. Thanks to the generosity of KUAF listeners, 2020, another year filled with the best news and music programs on air and online at KUAF.com. And with your help, we pledge to continue that in 2021. As this very long year ends, please consider making a tax-deductible gift to KUAF at supportkuaf.com. You can join the thousands of listeners who've already made their commitment to support KUAF. We have been talking about how there are no phone numbers or volunteers during this winter on-air fundraiser, how it's all online at supportkuaf.com, but you should know that you can always mail us a contribution at any time, old school. You don't even have to wait for these on-air fundraisers to make your gift. Hear a great story that made an impact on you? You can put a contribution in the mail. Impressed with the work we're doing with the Anti-Racism and Education podcast? You can mail in a check. Fan of the Pluto Manager and scratching the surface on Friday afternoons on 91.3? Send in a contribution that feels right to you. We know there are folks who don't make an online gift, and we want you to know that a mailed-in contribution works just the same as making a gift at supportkuaf.com. Our mailing address, 9 South School, Fayetteville, Arkansas, 72701. However you make a contribution, thank you so much from all of us at 91.3 KUAF and Ozarks at Large.
The KUAF Giving Tree is up, it's lit, and it's waiting for your much-needed support for those in our area who are suffering with food insecurity. This season, we're teaming up with Tricycle Farms, whose mission is to grow community through soil as they steward food awareness, education, and empowerment. Currently, they deliver an average of 437 pounds of food per day to partnering organizations. You can help out by dropping off your non-perishable food items here at KUAF, 9 South School in Fayetteville, and we'll get it to Tricycle Farms. Each Friday of December, we'd like to deliver them a full load of food, so we'll need a lot of help from our generous listeners. KUAF Public Radio and The Giving Tree, local matters.
And thank you, listeners, who have already stopped by the Carver Center for Public Radio with contributions to go under the KUAF Giving Tree. This is Ozarks at Large. President Trump continues to push his argument without legal victories or evidence that the election was rigged last month. Some members of his party continue to echo that concern, including some Arkansas GOP legislators. This week, Roby Brock, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, asked John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, how much he thinks those legislators believe the president's claims.
I think you'd have to take give some truth serum to all of them to get to the bottom of that. And I think if you did, you would see probably more than half who are playing along, but a significant and alarming number who truly believe that that the president got cheated out of his due reelection. Because you get out there among the people of Arkansas, and that's what you hear, and it's what people believe. If you were to take one of your polls, it would be a striking number in Arkansas who believe that somehow, some way, they can't tell you how, but they believe that Trump, of course, is a great man and would have won, and Biden could not possibly have won fairly, certainly not with Kamala Harris on the ticket with him, and Georgia, a southern state, give them a break. It's not so. Somehow, some way, he was cheated. I think that's a significant feeling in Arkansas, to the point that in what little I do moving around in the community, I hear it from people. Just in everyday life, they just accept that it must be at least partly true. Part of it is, boy, just wait and see. We haven't heard all of this yet. And it's the where there's smoke, there's fire. You hear that. And I think that's a lot of what's going on. Sometimes where there's smoke is just smoke, you know?
Yeah.
That's what we got, I think, in reality here.
Yeah. I agree with you on that. I mean, there's not been much fact to support or substantiate what has been out there. There is little argument that we are a divided nation. You and I have been seeing this in the polling numbers. We certainly see it in the election results. My question to you, though, is who are the factions that are divided in this country? Is it Republicans versus Democrats? Or are we seeing a civil war to some respects in some respects, within the Republican ranks.
There was a pretty good column, a full page column, in the editorial section of the Sunday New York Times by Ross Douthat, who is the New York Times idea of a conservative. And he is a thoughtful conservative, but one who's, as many thoughtful conservatives can say, he's about had it with Trump. And he identifies the nuanced components of all this. And he says Democrats and liberals and the mainstream media make a mistake by just dismissing it as primitive, unsophisticated, deplorable, horribly misinformed people who are about half crazy. That there are, that we've long had, it's a great American tradition for people to sit around socially and talk about how they don't believe the things they're being told. I've heard it all my life, socially, when I was a kid, my folks, my parents and their friends sitting around. Somebody in the group is going to, around having coffee, is going to start saying that Nixon really didn't do all that and the Democrats made it all up. You always have that. But social media has exploded it, and that's part of it. But it's not backwoods unsophisticates entirely. It's the barber. It's the cleaner. It's people you run into in everyday life who simply can't tell you what's going on exactly, but they don't trust what's happening.
All right. Let's go lastly here. The House and the Senate here in Arkansas have their legislative committees now. The House just met this last week to put some of their members in their positions, let them draw for their positions. Where do you see the battle lines being drawn in some of the committee assignments in anticipation of the 2021 legislative session?
Well, I had a column about this a couple weeks ago that I can now update a little bit with House information. It turned out that the Senate, in its committee selections, that sort of a right-wing all-star squad of the state Senate, Senators Garner, Ballinger, Alan Clark, Stubblefield, all loaded up the Judiciary Committee for the reason, for the purpose of passing a Stand Your Ground law, which they couldn't quite get passed last time through that committee. And also, the hate crimes bill. Of course, that was the main thing. Hate crimes bill would go to Judiciary Committee, and I'm told, and I wrote, and a couple of those senators on the right took ownership of what I wrote in their tweets. I'm told that they intend either to beat a hate crimes law, leaving Arkansas as one of two or three states without one, or pass one after amending out special penalties for acting on hate of gay people. That's a factor. Now, go over to the House and look at their Judiciary Committee. Do you know how many Democrats got on the Judiciary Committee? If everything works out and all the technical stuff works out, nine. We have nine Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee. People like Clowney, Tippi McCullough, Jamie Scott, Collins, you know, good center-left Democratic legislators. There are only, how many of them in the entire House? 23, 22?
That's right.
23. Nine of them right now sit on the Judiciary Committee, and they're sort of looking around and saying, can you believe they let us get this many on here? But nine's not enough to do anything. But nine is enough to make all the Republicans show up, you know, and it's enough to keep the votes close and make it interesting. So I'm looking at those two Judiciary Committees and assuming that whatever the Democrats might get done on the House side, if anything, gets blocked in the Senate on the governor's bill. It's not a left-wing bill, the governor's bill for a hate crimes law or Stand Your Ground. Abortion law bills could it conceivably go to judiciary or public health. The point is, there are super, super majorities of Republicans in the legislature.
John Brummett is a political writer with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns can be found at arkansasonline.com. He spoke with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics. More from their conversation can be found at talkbusiness.net. This is the 2020 end-of-year fundraising week at KUAF 91.3, and as part of this week, we're celebrating 30 years of Ozarks at Large with a couple of items connected to the show. We have compiled an Ozarks at Large double CD with 16 interviews and stories stretching across the past 3 decades. You can request this limited-run double CD with a contribution of $240 or a $20 a month sustaining membership during this fundraising week. And with that contribution, you can also receive a poster featuring the artwork from the cover of the CD that was created by Chad Maupin. Now, if you just like the poster and not the CD, you can receive that for a gift of $60 or a $5 a month sustaining gift to KUAF 91.3. The CD includes conversations with Willie Nelson, the voices of Bill Clinton and Sam Walton from the very first edition of the show I hosted in March 1990 when the governor and Walmart founder helped open the Walmart Museum on the Bentonville Square. You can hear Meredith Martin-Mote's visit to the annual World Championship Mule Jump that takes place in Pea Ridge. And you can hear what it sounded like when musicians entered a temporarily empty water tower on Mount Sequoia to record an original composition in those echoes of their adopted music hall. And in 2002, we had a visit to Hank Kaminsky as he was finishing the World Peace Fountain that's now an iconic part of the Fayetteville Square landscape. It was a cold winter day when he allowed me to tour his workshop and see the still-in-progress structure. He even allowed me to sit inside it before I left. Here is just an excerpt from that story, first aired almost 19 years ago on Ozarks at Large and included in its entirety on the new Ozarks at Large CD. Hank Kaminsky's new studio is a vast warehouse in South Fayetteville. The sign on the door reads, Village Sculptor. On a dreary, cold day this month, the largest space in the studio was full of sound, welding and sawing, but mostly sound from the overhead roar of heaters connected to the ceiling. The 6,000-square-foot location is much larger than Kaminsky's previous studio, a basement that measured about 1,500 square feet. But the extra room is required for Kaminsky's work in progress. As the artist explains, while tucked away in the office portion of the studio, smaller, more conventionally heated quarters, a few feet away from the work area.
This space has been waiting here for me. I first started working on this project, trying to raise consciousness and raise money, and I looked at this place 3.5 years ago, and it waited for me. No one else moved into this place, except for, you know, they did a little storage in here, but the guy who owned it would not rent it to anybody else until I moved in.
Hank Kaminsky, tall and with his graying hair tied back into a ponytail, believes strongly in fortuitous connections, like the right space for his work waiting for him. Which is not to say he blindly lets fate determine his direction. He understands that to make a dream such as his Peace Fountain become reality, there has to be some non-artistic administrative work. He took his longtime vision for the work to the architect of the town center, formed a committee to hammer out details, and created a proposal. Kaminsky says a breakthrough occurred when a committee member, John Lewis of the Bank of Fayetteville, connected Kaminsky with Bootsy Ackerman, long active in civic matters in Fayetteville. But the town center building is a publicly funded facility, and Kaminsky would have to wait out voters' approval of the building, subsequent litigation over the town center, and eventually a change in administrations at City Hall. He says the city never wavered on its support, and he knows that all things municipal are as much a part of creating public art as creating the sculpture itself.
Many artists think of themselves as serving their own inner needs, their own devotional activities. Art is a devotional activity for an artist. But as a member of the community, and with my particular bent on this, the name of my building, the name of my studio is The Village Sculptor. I feel that the artist is a part of the community, and those kinds of hassles are also a part of community life. So, it's frustrating, but it was not out of bounds in terms of the way that I positioned myself in the community.
The sculpture is, although not yet finished, quite a sight. A 10 by 10 globe covered in gray clay with the same simple prayer for peace in several languages built along the surface. Kaminsky and 14 assistants, part-timers and volunteers, have sculpted 7,000 pounds of clay onto the steel cage that serves as the core of the sculpture. In several dozen languages, the same message is written: may peace prevail on Earth. The sculpture is geometrically a sphere, but Kaminsky says it's also conceptually a sphere. At the center of that sphere is an idea.
I could say the idea is God. And every place on the surface of that sphere faces God, faces the center. So if there are little ripples, those little ripples don't face the center. And our first task was to take tools and scrape over the clay in such a way that every place on that surface faced the center.
That was just a piece from a story that first aired on Ozarks at Large in February 2002 when we traveled to Hank Kaminsky's studio in South Fayetteville as he was finishing the World Peace Fountain that you can now see and touch by the Fayetteville Town Center just off the Fayetteville Square. That story in its entirety is included on the new Ozarks at Large double CD that's available now. You can request it for a gift of $240 or a $20 a month sustaining membership to KUAF, a collection of 16 interviews and stories encompassing 30 years of Ozarks at Large. It's a limited run CD. There's also a poster of the artwork that's on the cover of the CD. You would receive that with your membership of $240 or $20 a month. If you just like the poster, that can be yours. You can request that for a gift of $60 or $5 a month sustaining gift. Now, if you'd like to celebrate all of KUAF and not just Ozarks at Large, for $120 or $10 a month, you can show off your love for KUAF with an iHeart KUAF tote bag. Great for toting, well, whatever you can tote. And it is reusable. All of that to help you become a contributing member of KUAF. Your contribution not just gets you a poster or a CD or a tote bag. Of course, it also means that you can continue to hear the great programming throughout the day, throughout the week, throughout the year in 2021. Your contribution in the amount that works best for you supports Morning Edition, The Pick and Post with Mike Shirky, Shades of Jazz with Robert Ginsburg, It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders on Saturday mornings, and all of the other programs, including the great classical music that you hear on KUAF2 and through the night on 91.3. You can make any contribution and all contributions at supportkuaf.com.
It's time for the annual KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. It's your chance to win a gift from KUAF and one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include American Shaman Kava Bar, Woodstone Craft Pizza, Botanical Garden of the Ozarks, and more. Winners announced Friday, December 11th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Details and registration available at KUAF.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Waldron. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Contributors to this Tuesday edition of our program included Antoinette Grajeda, Zuzana Sitek, and Jacqueline Froelich. Timothy Dennis produced our program. The conversations that take place most Tuesdays between John Brummett from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette and Roby Brock with Talk Business and Politics come to us via our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more at talkbusiness.net. You can learn more about us at ozarksatlarge.com. And you can listen to us when you want, how you want, by subscribing to our absolutely free podcast version of the program. It's available wherever you already get podcasts. And thanks to you for your continued support of your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF. You can make a contribution right now at supportkuaf.com, and thank you.